Well, welcome to the Picture House podcast and congratulations on Belfast, a truly beautiful paean to the city and its people.
Mama says if we went across the water, they wouldn't understand the way we talk.
If they can't understand you, then they're not listening. You know who you are, don't you?
Not many people know that you're actually from Belfast. And you actually went to the Grove Primary School that was featured in the film. How do you think that's such a well-kept secret?
I just think that, it happened a long time ago that I left. And then when I started working, having been through years of living in Reading and then going to London and then training as an actor, and then I suppose the most prominent thing that started to happen was the joy of being able to work on Shakespeare. And I think there's a sort of instant, as soon as you do any of that, you can be labeled in a certain kind of way. Thank God, but much of what we did was popular. But I think also people pigeonhole you as a kind of a certain, I don't know, they might imagine academic creature of a certain, who comes from a certain strata of English society. You sound a certain kind of way. And I think a lot of people, I think, used to feel that I finished filming and was quoting Shakespeare at the bus stop and on the way home and in the pub, and I had a big volume of the plays under my arm at all times. So I think they see what they see. So the association, thank God, with something that was working was with this particular playwright. I think now the truth is out.
Yes. and thank goodness for it. I mean, it's interesting because you burst onto our televisions as Billy, mm-hmm. didn't you? And, you know, portraying a very different story to the one that you're portraying now. And I just thought it was quite an interesting full circle in a way.
Yeah.
You know, we're very used to seeing Northern Ireland as a very bleak and humourless almost place and people's struggles. And even though you're story is one of struggle as well, and a choice, a very difficult choice. You have sort of set the record straight with the humour. It was just so funny.
Well, thank you. I mean, for me, it was a full circle moment in as much as one of the last images of Belfast is the family leaving on the bus. And 11 years later, I came back as a young actor. It was in my last term at drama school at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, which in itself sounds very fancy pants, but then to come back to play, as you say, a sort of darker character, but in a play by Graham Reid, television play back in the days when a new television play would have an audience, 5-6 million would play, you know, on mainstream television. And the reason to say that is that subsequent to that, I was aware that although you're right to say that story is very different from what we do in Belfast, what's similar is that the story concentrated not on the troubles primarily, but on a family and how they, so-called ordinary family, and how they deal with it. And I was made very aware by the reaction from that large audience, because you certainly would know what people thought the next day as you were going about your life, that they really appreciated having a different insight into Belfast and into Northern Ireland. Because as you say, generally, the impression was that it was essentially a war zone. You get off the plane and the bullets start flying and people are grim and all the rest of it. And there's no question of the seriousness of the situation. But the coping mechanism of human beings has to be at play at all times. And the Irish version that I certainly remember from my earlier days was of, as Shakespeare puts it, moving wild laughter in the throat of death, you know, a sort of grim gallows humor that would get you through things, and was also part of sort of putting your life back together again when it's subject to such sort of traumatic change, which is what happens at the beginning of our film.
And I was wondering as well with I know that it was lockdown that you began writing and thinking about the story. And I wondered if it was lockdown and the pandemic that gave you a kind of visceral reaction that maybe triggered the memory for you and opened a portal, if you will, for you to give you permission to write in a way.
One of the things that I don't know if it happened to you during lockdown, early on, within the first couple of weeks, I had lots of calls from people I hadn't heard from for ages. And I made lots of calls to people I hadn't seen for ages. And there seemed to be this sort of tremendous heartfelt desire to reconnect with anybody and everybody who's important to you, where the preciousness of the time and also this feeling of being unsettled and living in a kind of permanent unknown drove you to look at everything and anything that you felt to be precious and that you wanted started to enjoy and explore, and this sense of a story that had us in our street back in Belfast, locked down by two barricades that suddenly appeared at either end of the street, and you had to sign in and sign out of a clear blue sky, really, one summer's day in August of 69, and 2 hours later, life had changed completely. And this lockdown made me feel, I think, as many perhaps did, that you wanted to celebrate and return to, in the case of myself and my 9-year-old self, an atmosphere and a moment when a sort of childlike sense of wonder, an ability to be present and just enjoying whatever the heck life gave you on that particular day, and without being all sort of Pollyanna-ish about it, just really, and this happened to me early in this lockdown, from a ray of sunshine, you know, to a walk with the dog, to the call with the friend you hadn't spoken to in 6 months, to the meal that you were lucky to have. All of these things are recalibrated, a quite profound sense of how lucky we are to have the lives we have in many cases. And so I went back to a story that offered up the same thing and that same privileged life of relative happiness and relative security under threat. And in looking at the story of it, trying to work out, well, what matters to us and how do you navigate it?
And I know that you've called it an autofiction, and I thought that was a very interesting device, as well as I wondered if it gave you some sort of emotional distance as well to be able to navigate the story.
Well, I think the intention was never to, and this is a very Irish thing, you know, it's taken 50 years to write it, because a cardinal Northern Irish thing is to get above yourself, is to consider that your so-called problems or your particular issues are of interest to anybody else but yourself. I began to write this because I got past that and thought, well, no, I think that there are sort of universal scenarios in here that, are part of perhaps a necessary or a helpful process that goes way beyond sort of navel gazing and looks at, in some cases, just the simplicity of family life, if you're lucky enough to have one, if they're lucky enough to care about each other, when they have to make tough decisions about what their futures might be, when there are clear sort of sacrifices to potentially make. I think the sacrifices parents make for their kids are so extraordinary in so many small and large ways. And I've been really touched by the way in which when the film is played elsewhere in the world, people have said to me, that's my story. This is people in Africa, people in the Middle East, you know, people in America who say, no, the same rules apply. And so, you know, I think they found that there was a sort of mirror to be had in this that I had come to understand in lockdown was a way out. I knew now that this story was way beyond what it might have specifically meant to me. But, you know, as we so often observe, sometimes you get something very particular and it does have a sort of universal resonance because the particulars feel very authentic. And when I started sending the script round, that was what was so rewarding, to feel everybody got it, and people commented on the fact that they just felt the beat by beat and character by character, they somehow recognized an authenticity that was very familiar to them. So the recognition of the story was what allowed me to sort of believe that it could go to an audience that was beyond, as it were, my navel gazing.
I was surprised, and I really enjoyed the stylization of the film, because I've not seen your works, never resembled anything like that before. And it was absolutely beautiful, like with the gorgeous Hollywood black and white and lots of extreme close-ups and unusual POVs. They gave the film such a dreamy, catching at memory feel.
You know, I'm 50 years away from it, and I was 9 years old, and the goal was definitely to clearly avoid trying to make a sort of overtly political film, which was never the intention. The situation is too complex, and my understanding of it is not sophisticated enough, and many more brilliant minds than mine have done this in different kinds of ways. But the idea of a 9-year-old's perspective, sometimes physical perspective, on what he is seeing or hearing, and the way, as you say, in which memory, and a very Irish sort of notion, I think of it anyway, with people like the great masters Joyce and people like that, of a sort of stream of consciousness to do with your visceral, used the word earlier, experience of things, was something to let this, as it were, naive point of view emerge. Somebody said to me the other day about Picasso. They were talking about that work and saying, I'm not comparing this obviously, but the remark is interesting. Picasso said, it took me a year or two to learn how to paint, but it took me a whole lifetime to learn how to paint like a child. And in a sense, this idea of re-examining childlike but not childish wonder and appreciation was to do with finding that point of view. And especially, and this is maybe a childlike thing as well, was now as a 61-year-old filmmaker, was to listen to your instinct and just not censor it. So if you've now got so much experience and you have the life experience as well, if your gut is telling you that you want to be low on the ground behind Jamie Dornan's back as he stands at the door facing out the villain with a massive Belfast sky behind it, it doesn't really make literal sense, but that's how the boy's experiencing it. His father has to be a mountain against the elemental forces of the world that are crowding in on their little homestead in this kind of impressionist Western in his own mind, then follow that instinct and do it. And ultimately it will all add up. Don't try and second guess the audience. Let it come more directly out of your gut. That's what I tried to do.
Oh, and so successfully. I mean, every frame I felt was just filled with love and affection. And I loved the piece where Pop and Buddy are in the garden or in the yard and Judi Dench has sat in the window, and the framing of it is—it was just. I mean, I could take a picture and hang that on my wall, you know. And it's extraordinarily difficult to capture that kind of, like you said, like we discussed, the memory. And I was wondering about the storyboarding. I mean, were you meticulous about it?
Well, the kind of shot that you just mentioned where people get divided up into frames was partly how I experienced a small world, but everybody found their place. And someone like Granny was often at the window where she could watch the world go by. Granny and Granddad often in Belfast, weather often poor. So anytime it wasn't, you threw the windows open and you met with everybody. The promenading happened, you know, in these small streets outside people's front windows, and trying also to find, for me, there were these series of sort of portraits. So there's a shot in the film, I always takes my breath away. It's Katrina Balfe, who's a very fine looking gal. She's behind this window looking at the bad man, talking to her husband. There's a bit of curtain, but the dark in the black and white goes away into a sort of endless depth that you kind of feel you'd see in a Renaissance portrait at the National Gallery, those dark shadows and people in the front, very, very deeply contemplating what is going on, very powerful gaze. But in itself, it's a beautiful composition. I always think that frame is a lovely one. We just kept following our instincts. Harris Zambaloukos and I, we used natural light, and we wanted every story, as you were saying, to have somehow every framing, every moment to allow for a non-naturalistic way of telling the story as well. That could be just an experiential thing for the audience. This was the point of doing it in the cinema. And when I've seen this film play with a large, you know, or audience, I do get that sense of what makes cinema unique, because you can feel their sort of communal reaction being one of recognition and having a sort of, you can feel it in the audience having a second reaction, which is the fact of experiencing it together.
And onto your amazing cast. So Jude Hill, the sun shines from that little boy's face. I mean, tell me about finding and casting him.
A boy of great presence, a wonderful capacity for listening. And yes, as you say, that sort of bright, shiny, energized thing without it being sort of full of phony baloney that you can sometimes feel in even the most well-intentioned younger performers, you know, they kind of know what's expected. He, as it were, he is here now when he listens. And because we knew that we would often play scenes on his face, but with other people talking, his capacity to allow the story to write itself on his features, beat by beat, to be fascinated by why Catholics go to confession, or is Billy Clanton asking him to deliver things for him that he shouldn't, or what's happening between his parents, you know, and worrying about it. And in fact, one of the things I feel is touching is you see across the course of the film, and we more or less shot it in chronological order, this sense of, you know, what the film's partly about, which is the crossover between a period of innocence or youthfulness or sort of into that adult world where you start to anticipate or worry or start to ruminate. And there's a shot as his father is leaving once again early in the morning to go to England. We go back to find him in his bed. There's just a look in the eye where it's so heartbreaking to see how the shoulders have started to feel the burden of what it is sometimes to grow up and accept another thing that I think ended up becoming what the film is about. I didn't really realize it at the time, but it is about loss, whether it's the loss of your home, the loss of a country, the loss of your accent, the loss of, you know, a family and a way of life. And ultimately also the loss of loved ones, which is one of the things we all have to, you know, deal with in life. And he starts to sense that. And when he's on a sofa screaming at his parents, "I don't want to go to England," you know, he could as easily be saying, "I don't want to grow up. I don't want to know that life is full of all this stuff that's going to trip me up. Why can't we just get back out into that street without barricades and let me play with my Catholic neighbor and kick a ball about and for life to be all okay?"
Yeah. And it was such a beautiful balance of poignant sadness, you know, and grief with great humor. And I wonder, you showed it at the Belfast Film Festival. Was that the premiere of?
It was the first night of the Belfast Film Festival, and we had 1400 people at the Waterfront Hall in Belfast. And I mean, half of them seemed to be Jamie Dornan's family. the other half were Kieran Hines's family. And then the rest were all my cousins. So there was a big family atmosphere. It's sort of everybody in Belfast who's interested in film seemed to be there, and a lot of people who just wanted to support the movie. It was a very emotional night. Patrick Keelty introduced it with great brilliance, and we did a very emotional Q&A with a lot of people sharing stories. I think there was a pride in the real sense of pride in understanding, because the film starts in modern Belfast, that it's sometimes valuable to have stories where, you know, you can see where we are, which is a big, modern, you know, in many ways, very successful city, and see where we've come from and listen to some of those stories that are important to retell, lest we forget. And that sense, you describe it very well, of the combination of along the way, laughing all the things that we can and thank God do laugh at, but also, you know, acknowledging and feeling as well the melancholy that is sort of part of the human condition, part of the Irish condition for sure, where you just got to, You have to go with it. And an important part of the movie is a funeral and a wake, and then the complete release of joy that in the wake of really experiencing what it is to lose someone, is really reassert your determination to live life to the full for, you know, the time that you do have with the people that you're lucky enough to know and love.
Kenneth Branagh, thank you so much. There were so many more things I wanted to ask about, but you know, we're done for time. But it's been absolutely wonderful to talk to you about. The film is just wonderful. So thank you so much for making it.
Thanks so much, Lucy. I really appreciate it. Nice to talk to you again.